Hi, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Universal Narratives podcast, as we are continuing to explore the theme of social justice and equity in education. It's my pleasure to meet with Dr. Laura Kaplan today from Pace University to tell us a little bit more about the role of teacher preparation programs in helping teachers understand their role in the classroom and creating equitable spaces for all learners. Welcome, Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you, Dr. Wally. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. So maybe before we start, if you can tell us a little bit about your background, what you're currently teaching, your research interests, and we can take it from there.
Okay. My background is that of an ESL teacher for over 20 years. For those who don't know the term, ESL means English as a second language. Yes. Now the field has been evolving, and in New York City schools, for instance, the field is called ENL, mm-hmm. English as a new language. Mm-hmm. And as I taught, ESL or ENL to students in the Bronx, it became overwhelmingly clear to me that the students who had the highest literacy levels in their home languages were the ones who learned English most easily, A, and B, to a better level, to a higher level. And I became very interested in the role of literacy in the home language, which also led me to become interested in bilingual education mm-hmm. for new students arriving in this country. And I should say, I actually started my career as a first grade bilingual teacher teaching in English and Spanish to mainly Spanish speakers. So my direct expertise is teaching ESL to Spanish speakers. Okay. That's kind of the specialty I developed over the years and my focus of interest and research.
Great. So you're currently teaching at Pace University in the TESOL bilingual education department, and you're working with a lot of teachers who are soon going to be in their classrooms teaching very diverse learners. What do you think are the most, I would say, pressing matters or issues related to social justice and equity in education in our schools right now?
Wow, that's such a large question, and there's so many pressing issues. It's hard to identify one. So maybe I can just speak to two pressing issues that I think are of the most importance. And one is in the United States, teachers are overwhelmingly white, middle class, and female. Yet if you look at our schools in New York City, they're primarily populated by minoritized communities, whether those are Latin American communities, African American communities, Asian communities, Middle Eastern communities. And more our students in our schools are multilingual and multicultural. So one of my passions is teaching new teachers not only just to respect students' home languages and cultures, but to incorporate them into the classroom, to make them the subject of inquiry at the same time as they include parents, families, and communities mm-hmm. in the work of the school closely, and using the resources of the families and communities as subjects of study, making the best of families what we call cultural capital or areas mm-hmm. of expertise, including that as part of the curriculum. And this leads me again to one of my main concerns at the moment and something I hope to begin research on, which is that, well, let me back up and explain what is causing this problem, I believe, to a large degree.
Okay.
And that is federal education policy.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with No Child Left Behind in 2001, I believe it was passed into law in 2000, and George W. Bush signed it into law in 2001. And it was bipartisan legislation, by the way. There was this huge push to quote unquote, hold teachers accountable for student learning,
mm-hmm.
as if teachers are sitting on their thumbs all days in the classrooms. It kind of made teachers almost the enemy. It was a legislation that pointed to teachers as the cause of students' poor performance. But when we know, and research has shown, that there are so many variables, beginning with socioeconomic inequality in our country. And in fact, if you look at the test scores of students in wealthy areas or schools in upper middle class areas, you will notice that their test scores are competitive with the PISA scores of students from the highest performing countries who don't have an education gap.
Yeah.
But when you include all of the test scores, including students from high poverty districts, you will see that the test scores are much, much lower. And in fact, there's a one-to-one correlation between family income and students' performance on standardized tests. So this is where I think it's a social justice issue.
Mm-hmm.
Research has shown when you increase the economic well-being of families, the children's test scores rise. They've even done experiments where children from low-income neighborhoods are brought into schools in upper middle class neighborhoods, and they're the same students, their test scores begin to rise. Why? Because schools in this country are funded based on real estate taxes. So our schools in wealthy areas get much more funding. They have lower student teacher ratios in those schools. They have more funding for enrichment classes like art and theater and music and dance. They have all kinds of after school activities. They have trips, in many cases abroad. These are all elements that are missing in schools in high poverty areas. So back to No Child Left Behind. This legislation, which again was bipartisan legislation, was, in my opinion, completely misguided.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than looking at the research that's been done, which says we have to improve families' economic well-being before we can raise test scores, how can you teach children who are undergoing so much stress living in homeless shelters?
Yes.
And now, since the COVID pandemic, the rate of students living in homeless shelters in New York City alone has risen to 1 in 10. These are fundamental human needs that need to be addressed before we can start discussing equity in education. We need equity in healthcare. We need equity in housing. We need equity in social services. This is the larger holistic picture I believe we need to address.
I totally agree with that, because I supervise all over the city, and I have been to places in I would say the wealthiest parts of the city, as well as the poorest neighborhoods, or I would say very different socioeconomic backgrounds, and I can see the lack of facilities and resources. And you know what's also very sad? Teacher retention also in schools in lower socioeconomic backgrounds is not the same. And this kind of like affects the entire process of teaching and learning, the motivation of teachers, the motivation of students, the resources available. I totally agree that there has to be a grassroots movement to look at the problem from the very bottom before we start just remediating the symptoms, right? And finding solutions for the symptoms.
Exactly, Dr. Wally. And you raised another point I forgot to mention. In these wealthy school districts and wealthy areas, they can afford to teach, to pay the teachers much more money and higher salaries. So the best teachers, in fact, all teachers are want to go to these districts because they'll be earning much more money and probably teaching in better conditions, in better circumstances.
Yes.
So it's really a backwards scenario. We should be talking about paying teachers extra money to serve in high poverty areas where the educational need is the greatest. But instead, our situation is in reverse. So going back to No Child Left Behind, what this legislation did, it further exacerbated the problem. It says we're going to hold teachers and schools accountable rather than looking at the holistic picture. It said it's teachers' fault and it's teachers and schools' responsibilities to raise test scores. And we're going to issue and institute this standardized testing and hold teachers accountable for their students receiving high scores on these tests. And if they don't, we're gonna penalize schools and withhold money. We may even, originally, it was even more punitive than it is now. It said, we're going to close schools where the test scores aren't high. You know, totally disregarding the other factors that go into students scoring well on tests, like having parents who are literacy minded, who read to their children every day, who have
There is a lot of parents who are basically not available because they're working all day and the children are not getting the support that they need, especially when it comes to literacy. Research says that being there, the vocabulary you use with your children, the books that you read with them, the activities you engage with them really affects how much vocabulary they know and the language that they use. And that's not available to a lot of kids in our city, especially. So Dr. Kaplan, now you spoke about the major issues or the underlying issues for this. And you mentioned also how the No Child Left Behind kind of made the problem even more complicated, especially for English language learners and the students who come from backgrounds where English is not their main language. How is testing, I know this is a very controversial question, how is even standardized testing for students who are not native speakers of English valid, I would say? I would use the word valid for now.
I would characterize it as cruel and unusual punishment, these standardized tests. It's creating severe anxiety in all of our students. And then when you compound it with students who are recently arrived, in New York City, they get just a 1 year window of relief where they don't have to take the tests for the first year that they arrive. But we know as teachers of ENL, we know that the research shows for students to arrive at grade level proficiency, what Jim Cummins refers to as CALP, mm-hmm. for cognitive academic language proficiency, they need 5 to 7 years to catch up.
So yet
they are being given the same standardized tests as the general population after only 1 year of being in the country. This is not only counterintuitive, makes no logical sense, it's really going against research and the best research practices. So it's also has another negative effect, which I wanted to speak to, which is that because schools these days are under so much pressure to mm-hmm. raise their students' test scores due to the punitive nature of federal education legislation, schools are going to all kinds of ridiculous measures to teach to these tests.
Yes.
And so students are losing out on a well-rounded education. Tests are having a very nefarious effect on the education, particularly of students in minoritized communities and communities where there are high populations of ELLs. Because I even went to an elementary school in East Harlem, and the pressure is coming down from the top, right? Mm-hmm. This is obviously not a grassroots pressure to have students perform better in the test. It's coming from the federal government, down from the state government, down to the city government, down to the principal. Yes. And at this particular elementary school that I visited, the principal decided to cancel all other subjects except for English and math, because English and math are the subjects that are tested in these standardized tests. Mm-hmm. So this means phys ed was eliminated for these elementary school students. This makes absolutely no sense. Mm-hmm. We know young children need to run around and their brains function better if mm-hmm. they can move and be active during the school day. These children had no science, no social studies, no art, no music. It was a completely watered down curriculum. This was one school that I observed. Furthermore, during every period, they're feeling the pressure, because the teachers are having pressure put on them. And it's almost humanly impossible for the teachers not to convey this anxiety to the students they are mm-hmm. teaching. So the poor young children are feeling this anxiety that they need to do well on the tests. I know children who on the day of the tests are overcome with so much anxiety, they tell their parents, "I'm sorry, I can't go to school today," mm-hmm. and they're staying home. I actually think that's a good thing. And I encourage my students in teacher education to inform the parents in their schools that they have the right, and families, that they have the right to opt out of these standardized tests. Mm-hmm. And they should be opting out of these standardized tests. Just visit, you can Google opt out New York City, and you will get the website with letters already drafted in different languages that can be presented to families that they in turn can sign and send to their children's principals, so that the children can opt out of these dreadful exams.
That's really very insightful. You know, I recently did a project where I looked at something very similar to what you said, how schools are not teaching civics and social studies sometimes because they're just teaching to the test and they're focusing on English and math. And it was like a national kind of study. I can't remember the institution that produced the report, but when they asked students like nationwide about the location of certain cities around the world, students were not able to even like, you know, locate certain major cities in the US because they're lacking the experience and the exposure to this kind of content in their classrooms. And it just takes you back to the whole idea of a well-rounded education. It's missing, definitely. And we're just focusing on whichever skills are going to be covered in the test, which creates a very, very stressful atmosphere for teachers, parents, and families. So opting out is an option. Everybody can do that, but unfortunately, a lot of people are not aware of that option. So thanks for making that clear to all teacher candidates listening to this. So how do you and other colleagues in your department at Pace University discuss issues of social justice and equity with future students? Or future students or future teachers?
That's a very good question. And mm-hmm. we each do it, I would say individually in our yeah. own individual ways.
Yes.
As I mentioned at the beginning, I emphasize with my students the importance of incorporating families' languages and cultures into mm-hmm. the curriculum of the school. Now, some students say to me, yes, but I don't speak Hindi. I don't speak Bengali. I don't speak Tagalog. I don't speak Mandarin. I don't speak Spanish. I only speak English. I don't speak the languages of my students. I only speak English.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many, many ways that students can incorporate the languages of their students in the classroom without actually speaking those languages. First, they can learn how to say hello, good day in each of the students' languages, and then display on the walls those greetings so that every morning students see the greeting present in their native language. They can have students become experts and teach the rest of the class songs in their native languages, for example. They can sing happy birthday to other students in their native languages. Then, as far as doing work, teachers can partner students who have the same home language, especially if there's a higher level English speaking student. That student can be partnered with a lower level English speaker to help translate and explain the English to the student. Home language groups can be formed so that students can discuss a topic richly before producing a product in English or a paper in English.
Mm-hmm.
There are many and multiple strategies that can be used even if the teacher does not speak the home language of the students.
Yeah, I would also add diversifying classroom libraries, books by authors from different backgrounds so that students can see themselves represented. Of course, we discussed representation earlier that students do not see themselves in their teachers sometimes, and they look forward to having role models that look like them and come from the same background. But I really think that we have, like, our teacher population is really changing. I have been working with teachers now for over 6 years, and I have seen that we have teachers of every background now. When I first started working with teachers, it was, as you said, white, female, middle age, and now it's everybody, which is great for our students because the majority of students in our classrooms are Hispanic, followed by African-American, followed by white and Asian, followed by, you know, multiracial kids also makes a very big, including my children, makes a big portion or percentage of our student body in our schools. So it's just very important to diversify our practices, keep in mind all these different approaches to learning, and also understand that what we think is acceptable in a class might not be acceptable in certain cultures. So we have to also teach ourselves about these cultures and these different, you know, little things that make cultures very unique. Like, you know, even, you know, a topic that always comes up is parent communication. Sometimes teachers assume that when parents don't communicate with them, it's because they don't care about their kids' education. And as we talked earlier, sometimes parents are not available. Sometimes they do not speak the language. Sometimes in their cultures, they're not really involved in that kind of process. So just keeping in mind all these differences, I think, really helps a new teacher navigate their way in their classroom, maybe for the first few years. Behavior management, of course, has to be also flexible and adjusted to meet the different needs of students that we have in our classrooms. That's great, great work. So that the follow-up question now would be something that you also brought up earlier, which is the pandemic. And it kind of like amplified issues of equity and social justice. How would you, how do you view that? How do you view the role of the pandemic in amplifying these problems? And how should we react to that as educators and teacher educators?
Well, there's no question that the pandemic has exacerbated this problem almost to no end. Yeah. Many students, when they were faced with virtual classrooms, virtual lessons, just turned off their cameras and put on their headphones and watched video games and literally did nothing, learned nothing over a 1 year or 2 year period. So it's just, however, in those families which had resources, maybe they had one of the parents stay home and work with the children, with their children, assist them in their classes, assist them with their homework. We know that children from poor and working class families mostly did not have this advantage. So they in turn fell further behind. Mm-hmm. Some students, even if the parents weren't there, you know, those parents who have resources could ensure that a caregiver or a babysitter was home. Someone was home to walk the students through their classes and their homework. This was just not available to poor families. So the gap has gotten wider. The gap has gotten worse. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is redouble down on the efforts and strategies that we know work, like having one-on-one instruction, having that kind of tutoring to help bring students back up to grade level. Students just in casual conversations I've had with teachers in the schools, they think that some of their students are have fallen like a year to three years behind now. Yet, because of these standardized testing, the pressure is put on the teachers to be teaching at grade level and to have students performing at grade level. Yeah. That is not recognizing the reality of the pandemic and its consequences that we faced in the past few years. So, I would say we need a immediate moratorium on standardized testing. We know we are taught, and this is what we teach in the PACE School of Education. These are principles that come from the best educational theorists, mm-hmm. starting from John Dewey and Jean Piaget. You start where children are at. You start where they're at. You don't say it's totally counter, as I said before, best research. You don't say, oh, okay, you're here, but third grade level is here, so you've got to do this level. The yeah. students will not magically jump up to this level. Mm-hmm. We have to
scaffold them
yeah. to arrive at the grade level, and this takes time. Politicians should not be deciding educational policy. Experts and educators should be. And this legislation has to end. And I think we shouldn't be shy about telling our teacher candidates this. Teachers in the field, we have to involve communities. We need to get grassroots organizing going to push to overturn these tests. They're cruel and unusual punishment, and they're against the best practices in the field.
So speaking about best practices and research, there is always that gap that exists between what researchers and college professors know is right and what's being done at schools. A lot of times you hear educators in schools saying that, well, professors are not in the classroom. They don't understand what kind of challenges we're going through. So how can we bridge the gaps between what research says and our work as educators in teacher prep programs and what's happening in our schools right now?
Well, that's why I consider myself a social justice educator, because I think we need to make families and communities aware of what's happening and what the best practices are in the schools, so that we can include them. We can include them in our schools, include them in helping shape policies for our schools, include them in pressure campaigns, whether it's going to talk to politicians, writing letters, having the children themselves make presentations to the politicians about why they think standardized testing is a bad idea. And we need to get this federal legislation changed. Leave educational policy up to the educators, not politicians, and involve the community in helping to create this change that we want to see.
I love that. I love the community engagement part, because it's certainly, I would say, the most effective tool to enforce change. And without the community being involved, it's very, very difficult to have an impact in any way. So first making them aware of their rights and their children's rights, and then working together to try to make a difference.
Yes, absolutely.
So my last question would be, there is a lot of teacher and leader preparation programs that are now moving towards a more racial, social justice minded programming for their courses. What are some of the gaps that we have right now in our teacher preparation programs? Not necessarily in PACE, but in universities overall. And what kind of course offerings and trainings do we need in the future for future teachers?
Well, that's a really good question. And it just so happens that at PACE, we are about to institute in the fall of 2022 something called anti-racist education learning objectives in many classes around the university. And let me see if I can show you, if my computer cooperates, what they are. And could you allow me to share my screen?
I think I already did. So
you did?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can bring these up for you. It may take just a minute, but I think that, okay. So these are the, they called ARE learning objectives, or anti-racist education learning objectives. Mm-hmm. And we're encouraging all faculty in the School of Education and outside to incorporate these learning objectives into their classes. So the first one is a focus on inequalities. Develop a critical awareness of how racial and ethnic inequalities, antagonisms, and or solidarities emerge through individual, collective, and institutional actions, and or how they change historically and or how they vary geographically or transnationally. So focus on inequalities.
I love the piece where it says examples of how you can do that in class for each.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yes, and I can send these to you if you like, because you might want to consider making your classes, giving them, having them fall under anti-racist education learning objectives as well. I can talk to you later about how to do that.
Okay.
But knowledge making, explore how race, ethnicity shape the production of knowledge in a field, discipline, or practice, and or compare and debate theories, analytical perspectives, and research methodologies on race, ethnicity, and racism across disciplines. Or if you want it for short, you can split, you can say, explore how race, ethnicity shape a field.
That's an amazing point actually to bring up, because there is a discussion about how there are so many ways of knowing, and how sometimes we know things because we just get it from one source, and we assume that because it comes from that source, that it's correct. And we assume that we can actually generalize that knowledge to communities and cultures and subcultures where, you know, it's a whole different kind of practices and traditions. So that's actually a great point to bring up, especially for educators.
Yes. I'll show you a third disposition, intersectionality. Mm-hmm. Analyze the intersections and interactions between race, ethnicity, and other social identities, experiences, and formations. For example, language, religion, nationality, indigeneity, class, or aspects of embodiment that can lead to disproportionate impacts and or significant cultural differences. And short form is analyze how race, ethnicity intersects with other social identities and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Four is change making, evaluate and or apply strategies, tactics, and skills for challenging, transforming, or dismantling systems of racism in real world case studies or community engagement. So evaluate and apply ways to change racist inequalities and racial tensions in a community. So we're going to be incorporating this objective into our classes. And the last one are BIPOC contributions and perspectives. Discuss texts, knowledge, and culture produced by Black, Indigenous people of color, communities and individuals in ways that affirm those contributions and perspectives and enable challenges to dominant group perspectives, including white supremacism. So this is something else we want to be mindful of and incorporate into our classes. So anyway, that gives you a little idea of what we're looking to do at the Pace School of Education. And at PACE as well, to incorporate these anti-racist learning objectives into our curriculum for the benefit of all our students.
Yeah, I think it would even be great to discuss them with School of Education students and just highlight how important each one of these categories is for just seeking knowledge in general and applying knowledge where they are going to be in the future. So that's definitely a great start. I love that. Thank you so much for bringing that up and for sharing the screen and showing us the different categories. So Dr. Kaplan, do you have any final remarks or maybe thoughts that you want to share with us before we end this?
Just that I think that social justice education is equitable education. It is teaching for equity, inclusion, and empowerment. It involves incorporating our communities in our teaching, inviting family members to come to our classes to share their unique knowledges. It includes having students go out to their own communities to explore and examine their communities and find out what the needs of their communities are so that they can advocate for change and improvement. Students have to learn how to do research, starting with their own environments. And they have to learn that they can be change agents as well, not just automatons who have to memorize information for standardized testing. No, that's not what we want to create.
Yeah, we ultimately want to make sure that we our students are active citizens in the future who are able to change injustice and challenge situations that are not fair to everyone and understand privilege and make sure that they provide the support needed to unprivileged groups. You know, there is a book we're talking a lot about culturally responsive teaching, but I'm sure you're familiar with a culturally responsive school leadership book by Khalifa. It came out in 2018. It focuses a lot on establishing community connections and leadership, school leadership, focusing on partnering with parents, people from the community, teachers walking outside of the classroom, going to the bodegas, learning about what's happening in the community, and making sure that practices in the classroom are, I would say, stem from these communities and give back to the community so that students would develop this understanding that as a citizen of this community, as part of this community, it's my role to work hard to change things and make sure everything is just for everyone. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Kaplan. That was really insightful. I really love our conversation and the document you shared. I would really appreciate it if you can share that with me afterwards. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with you in the future.
Sure. I look forward as well to our future collaboration, Dr. Walig. And thank you for inviting me today.
No problem. Thank you.